Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to this episode of Fake TV Critic, a podcast where I discuss the week's biggest TV news headlines, recap and analyze some of my favorite shows, and let you know what you should be watching. I have a fancy new microphone this week, so we're going to see how this goes. I apologize if I am blowing your ears out. I don't mean to. So a couple of people did get in touch with me. Please continue to do so if you would like, and let me know what the hell you want to hear. Do you want the news? Do you not want the news? Do you need the recommendations and the premieres and finales? Do you want me to focus on one thing per week instead of two? Are there specific shows you would like me to talk about? A couple of you said that you don't care about the news section so much, so I've decided that I'm going to mostly get rid of that unless there's like, you know, some type of story that's been happening throughout the week that, you know, I feel either compelled to talk to or that I like, you know, even though this isn't paid, I don't have a contract, like in a way contractually obligated to talk about, just because like it's been, you know, so prevalent, which is what I'm going to do this week. The biggest TV news story of the week is actually not really even about TV, but it is about a TV star, and that TV star is James Corden of The Late Late Show and also of The Gay Minstrelsy. All of his roles he's taken away from fat gay men like me. Anyway, so this is the weirdest shit. Apparently this week, the owner of the restaurant Balthazar, Keith McNally. Well, and if you don't know what Balthazar is, it's like a fancy upscale New York, a fancy upscale restaurant in New York that, you know, like used to be, especially, you know, in the 80s, 90s, that kind of time, very famous for its celebrity clientele and being like a place to be seen in New York and socialites and, you know, whatever, and Broadway stars, and everyone used to hang out there, like, you know, to be seen on the scene, basically. And honest to God, I did not know this restaurant was still open. I kind of thought that a lot of those restaurants were going away, like Tavern on the Green closed. That might be reopened again, so maybe I don't know. It was another one of the same kind of deals, but apparently it's still open. And apparently James Corden loves to go there and berate the staff, which, like, it's so funny to me that the celebrities that always end up being the most unlikable in real life are the ones that try really hard to be likable in the way they present themselves. Like Ellen is, all these stories are coming out. I mean, they've been out there for years. Like, you know, Kathy Griffin used to talk about it in her stand-up, like, you know, 15 plus years ago. So this isn't like new news for everyone, but, you know, the popular narrative of Ellen DeGeneres now is that she's an awful person to work for or with. And that story is being corroborated by dozens and dozens and dozens of people, from behind the scenes folks to people that, to other celebrities that have worked with her, like Grayson Chance, who was a kid who used to sing on her show that she credits herself with discovering and giving a record deal on her own record label. He's come out recently with his new album releasing about how awful she made him feel, and she took credit for his success but then dropped him like a hot potato when he wasn't a cute little singing kid anymore. And that's what Grayson Chance, go look that story up too. But James Corden is another one like that, where he like has this persona on his, like, his hosting duties on Late Night and elsewhere, where he just seems to want to be like the funny fat friend, and the roles that he takes on in film tend to paint him as like the fun sidekick and like as funny and bubbly and cute, whatever. You know, he's done like the Peter Rabbit movies and Cats, and like he seems to be very like family friendly and silly. But then all these stories now are coming out this week of him being like a ridiculous asshole in real life. So Keith McNally, who runs, I don't know which, Balthazar, Instagram posted that he was banning James Corden from his restaurant and gave these stories of James Corden eating there a few times and being an asshole. And like one of them was that he ate there in June of this year and found a hair in his food and said, if you get us another round of drinks this second and take care of all of our drinks so far, I won't write any nasty reviews on Yelp. Which like, I also find that funny. Like just imagining James Corden, like, I don't know, in his, like waiting for the cameras to go up as he's rehearsing the Late Late Show and just like on his phone on the Yelp app, just being like, Balthazar is shit. My waitress was terrible. I found a hair and she would not give me free drinks for it. Like, that's just funny to me. And then there was another instance. This is the one that's been making the rounds more so on the internet. And apparently the reason why he was actually banned is that earlier this month, James Corden and his wife were at brunch. And his wife ordered an omelet with egg yolks and Gruyere cheese with a salad. I'm going to read the post now. A few minutes after they received the food, James called their server and told her there was a little bit of egg white mixed in with the egg yolk. The server informed the floor manager. The kitchen remade the dish, but unfortunately sent it with home fries instead of salad. That's when Corden began yelling like crazy to the server. You can't do your job. You can't do your job. Maybe I should go into the kitchen and cook the omelet myself. The waitress was very apologetic and brought the manager over to the table. He returned the dish, and after that, everything was fine. He gave them promo champagne glasses to smooth things out. The manager said that Corden was pleasant to him, but nasty to the server. The server was very shaken, but continued to finish her shift. And then now all of these other stories of people on Twitter who are working in the food service industry are coming out about James Corden just generally being an asshole and kind of treating everyone this way, including people on his own show. And, you know, there was a story, or he was on a, maybe Rachel Ray or something, I forget. Don't quote me on that part. Where he couldn't name any of his camera operators, which, like, how do you run a show? Like, how are you the face of a show and you don't know your own crew members? That's bad. That's bad. And that, I guess just generally he's known in New York and beyond for just being very difficult. And I don't know. I guess I should just stop being surprised when celebrities turn out to be awful, because most people are awful and celebrities are just people. But I don't know. I feel like this is a really weird one because it's James Corden and like people don't like him to begin with. So like, why? You know what I mean? And I mean, obviously people like him, but the popular internet opinion is that he is a blowhard and he takes on all these roles where he's playing like gay minstrel characters. I'm in that boat. And that he's just like annoying and over the top. And like, even there are a whole bunch of people on Twitter and Instagram in Great Britain were like, you can cancel him, but we are not taking him back. So like, he's just generally, I feel like, accepted as an annoying person. And I mean, part of that, he's always singing. This is what it is. He comes across as a try-hard theater kid. And as a former try-hard theater kid myself, I can make that observation. James Corden is the kind of theater kid who in high school is always like, I don't do this for the drama. I do it because I love it. But then like creates all the drama. That's like, he's the kid who's always like, who looks down on you if you say you love Wicked, but then will be the first to offer you his opinion on what like the best Michael John LaSchwiza score is. You know what I mean? Like, he's that kid. And that's, no one likes that kid. We just don't. We don't like the, that's why most kids who are that in their high school drama club or their high school musical grow out of it eventually, because we know once we get a little bit more self-awareness, when we reach our young adulthood in like 18, 19, 20, 21, our college years, or what would be our college years if you don't go to college, we kind of can reflect and be like, oh, we're annoying. I get it now. And we reform. Or we leave it all behind. Or both. James Corden, I feel like, didn't do that. He made it his personality. And that's a hard personality to have. So, of course, he is also in real life awful. Because that theater kid is awful. Did I just crack the James Corden code? Maybe. Maybe I did. Maybe I'd. If the New York Times wants to call me and quote this podcast, please feel free. But regardless, this whole story like blew up, and James Corden has done, like, now had to do interviews because he's promoting a new Amazon Prime show that's coming out next month. And they're, of course, asking him about this because the story is so silly that it just blew up on the internet. And he has to now talk about how he thinks it's so silly and it's beneath him. And he's basically shrugging it off, which, like, you have to, I think. But also, it doesn't do anything to help rehab that image of you as an asshole. Because, like, the whole problem here isn't so much that you, like, made a scene or that you... It's that you made a clear distinction... Like, you are a Karen. You made a clear distinction between the server and the manager. And you are a dick to the server and not to the manager. Whether that is because the server was younger or a woman or in a quote-unquote lesser position, I don't know. He does, obviously. But you chose to speak to that server in a condescending, rude, insensitive, mean way. And it made her feel, or made them, I think it's, I feel like the message said it was, anyway, made the server feel terrible, but then you didn't treat the manager that way. And you, like, threw a temper tantrum until you got some free stuff when you are a person who can afford to pay. You know what I mean? Like, so yeah, you kind of have to shrug it off because it is a very silly story to have gone so viral. But it also really speaks to, like, who you are as a person. I've heard so many people say this, and it's very true. The way you treat servers at restaurants and the way you treat, like, customer service people when you're on the phone with them, the way you treat, like, anyone who is coming to, like, perform a service for you or you are going and having a service done for you, the way you treat those people speaks volumes about who you are as a person. I 100% believe that. If you're an asshole to servers at restaurants, if you are an asshole to, like, the checkout person at, I don't know, Wawa or 7-Eleven or Sheetz or whatever, if a retail worker asks if you need help and you snap at them rather than saying, no, thank you, I'm okay for right now, you're an asshole in real life because that's you feeling like you have power over someone and wielding it. So I also would like him to apologize and be like, yeah, I'm sorry, sometimes I'm just a dick. Like, you can do that. You can just say, you know what? Yeah, I was being an asshole that day. Sorry. I can't promise it'll never happen again, but I'm going to try a bit harder. Do you know what I mean? But he didn't. He's just now begrudgingly talking, like, oh, I guess I'm going to have to talk about it on my show. I take back my apology. Because now he's, like, just fighting with Keith McNally, the owner of Balthazar, on Instagram. Who like, after all this happened, said that he was welcome back. But so then James McCorden said, well, then I'm not sorry. And now he might be banned again. I don't fucking know. The whole thing is very stupid, but also very entertaining. And again, I am not a James Corden fan. So I found it very funny for this whole thing to have happened. All right, so that's the only news story I want to talk about this week. But I'm going to go right into the rest of the episode. So basically, this is going to be my Halloween episode because Countdown to Christmas is officially happening. I'm recording this over the weekend of October 21st through the 23rd. And Hallmark Channel and Hallmark Movies and Mysteries have both started round-the-clock, 24-hour-a-day Christmas/holiday, but like 99% Christmas movies, and I am very excited. And there has already been a new movie. There are two tonight. This is Saturday, and another tomorrow on Sunday. So as of next week, all my recommendations are going to be Christmas-based, despite the fact that next week's episode comes out on Halloween. Don't care. Listen to it on Tuesday. But because this is my Halloween episode, I'm going to talk about some spooky shit. And my recommendation is going to be some spooky shit. So first up, let's talk about this new Ryan Murphy show coming hot on the heels of his Dahmer show. We have The Watcher on Netflix, which is a 7-episode limited series. And I watched this whole thing in a weekend, and I want to make sure that I'm clear that this is not a good show. It's not well written. It doesn't do anything interesting. It does not tell, like, a really intriguing story. It's just one of those shows that is very well paced and is, like, just weird enough that it keeps you interested, and the performances are great, but, like, there's nothing, the show does nothing. It just is there. So I want to make that clear. Having said that, like I said, I watched the whole thing in one weekend. It's very quick. It is mind-numbing. I couldn't tell you half of what happened in the show, but I did watch the whole thing. So The Watcher is like very loosely based on this story that was in New York Magazine. What year is it? Maybe 5 years ago. About a house in North New Jersey. I think it is actually in Westfield, which is the name, which is the same town the series is shot in, which, like, I'll get to why that's weird in a second. But so it's a true story in New York Magazine about a couple who bought a house and got immediate creepy vibes from all of their neighbors and started receiving like threatening anonymous letters from someone signing them The Watcher, who basically was saying shit like, you need to feed the house young blood, I can see you, I'm gonna be watching you. And like, they had weird ass neighbors, like someone was installing their internet or their cable or something like that, and said he looked over the fence and saw two of the neighbors had set up lawn chairs facing the house, like not facing the sun, not facing a pool or anything, but like facing this house they bought. And it just like, they got like weird feelings from the house. And now in real life, this couple never moved in. There's no like weird history with the house, but it did freak them out, understandably. And when this story went viral after this article, I want to say in like 2017 or 2018, they had a hard time selling the house, and they eventually did. But what is weird about this show is that it takes that premise, which is very interesting. Like, that is that's some real life shit that you can't make up kind of stuff, where like try as you might to creep someone out, only truth could be this crazy, right? Of that, like, you move into your dream house, and before you ever set foot into it or move a single fucking piece of furniture, someone is sending you letters about how they're gonna always be watching you, that they have a legacy of their whole family's watched this house, and you need to, and you're so glad you have kids because the house needs young blood. So fucking weird, right? Like, that is something that only truth could be that strange. But what is not so interesting is that to make this into like a 7-part series, you obviously have to embellish, because the family did not move in. There was never an explanation, so they don't know what happened. They just eventually unloaded the house. So like, that's not it's not interesting to have a series about a family who buys a house that they never fucking go to. Do you know what I mean? So to make it entertaining, they had to add a whole bunch of shit that also made it stupid in a lot of ways. So that first episode where they receive the letter, where they get into the bidding war, and like a lot of the characters they added are super fun. And that first episode is the reason that I continued to watch the rest of the series. And also weird about this whole thing, it, you know, like aside from the fact that most of it is fucking made up, is that they use the actual town and the actual address. 657 Boulevard is the actual address of the real house. So now, like, whoever this poor family is who bought the house, who like I guess is not getting watcher letters, even though the people who owned it before did, are now having to deal with like crazy asses who watch the show on Netflix and then just start fucking driving by like they are the watchers. Like, you people, y'all need to get a grip. I said this in my episode about Dahmer. Y'all need to get a fucking grip. This is TV. And I know that I get super involved in like the housewives and I have very strong opinions. It is of them on TV. It is not of them as people or in real life. Like, I hate Lisa Rinna. I think she's awful on the show. And that probably means she's awful in real life. But like, I don't know her in real life. I don't want her to die. I don't want her to like never work again. I don't want her to have to go into hiding. But I do want her off of The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. Do you know what I mean? There's a very clear and distinct difference to me anyway of the way that I feel about these things versus the way that some other people do. Like, I was just, what the hell was I watching? I watched this movie yesterday called The Outwaters. I went to the Lambertville Halloween Film Festival, which, like, I'm in Lambertville in New Hope in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and like there's this little tiny theater that used to be a grocery store. It's called the Acme Screening Room, Acme. And they're doing a Halloween horror film festival. And one of the movies they showed, it just got acquired by Screambox, the streaming service. And it's going to be in theaters next year and then on streaming on this service. But anyway, the movie was like a found footage movie. And it's very much inspired by the Blair Witch Project. And I kept thinking, as I was talking to the director after this movie, I kept thinking about how in 1998 or 99, whenever that movie came out, like, people did not understand in a lot of cases that it was fiction because they used their real names, the actors' real names. They didn't understand that this was, like, a planned movie. Like, people were calling the cops in Maryland, like, encouraging them to go looking for these people in this movie. Which, like, logically, how fucking stupid are you? But, I mean, like, that you don't think the people who made this movie and released it, like, you don't think that if this was, like, actual crime footage, that one, they'd be playing it in a movie theater in whatever your bumfuck town is, or two, that, like, they would have shown it to the cops first. Like, it's just, it's so stupid. But that's the level of, like, the blurred line of reality that we lived in even then, and it's even worse now. So the fact that there are people who, like, cannot differentiate between, like, crime stories for entertainment versus crime stories that are, have a real life and real world effect. The fact that, like, people are just going to this house is wild to me, but, like, why did they change so much of the story but didn't change the address? Like, what the fuck were they thinking? And what are the legalities there? That's interesting to me. Anyway, back on track. The Watcher is 7 episodes, like I said. It is written by Ryan Murphy and Ian Brennan, who do the American Horror Story series and just did Dahmer and a whole bunch of other shit. And it stars Naomi Watts, Oscar nominee, Bobby Cannavale, double Emmy winner from Boardwalk Empire and Will and Grace and Vinyl on HBO and a bunch of other shit. The queen, who's having her moment in the sun, thank the Lord, Jennifer Coolidge, recent Emmy winner for The White Lotus. Emmy winner Margot Martindale, Richard Kind, who you will absolutely recognize as that guy from That Thing. Mia Farrow, Woody Allen's ex, mother of Ronan Farrow, I believe an Oscar nominee herself. Don't quote me on that. Terry Kinney from Oz. Christopher McDonald, who is on Hacks right now, recently nominated for an Emmy, but well known to millennials as Shooter McGavin from Happy Gilmore. Noma Dumizwani, who was in Harry Potter and the Cursed Child on Broadway and on the West End, Tony nominee. Joe Mantello, who is currently starring on this season of American Horror Story NYC, Emmy nominee for The Normal Heart and multiple Tony winner. And then we have, like, you know, a bunch of really fun guest stars as well, including Jeff Hiller and Seth Gable, who was on this past season of American Horror Stories. And it's just, the cast of this could not be better. It's fantastic. But what I find happens a lot is that when you have a great cast like this, and this happens quite often on American Horror Story, they are better than the material, so it makes the material look worse than it actually is. And that's what's happening here with The Watcher, is that the show is not good enough for these actors. So while we get some amazing work from Bobby Cannavale, who, like, has to play, he's the husband who moves in and, like, slowly, not even slowly, very quickly starts to, like, lose his mind and become, like, a conspiracy theorist. And then he has all these outside forces. Like, he is not doing well at work, and he has these financial woes because of the house, and then the threats and the crazy neighbors, and his personal life starts to fall apart because of all these other stresses. That, like, seeing him have, like, these basically, like, breakdown moments and where he ends up by the end of the show versus where he started is a really great arc that Bobby Cannavale gave. Not so much, I think, that the writing gave. Like, Naomi Watts barely has anything to do. So even though she is very intriguing to watch as an actress, she's not given enough to do, and her character isn't interesting. She's like the straight man. You know, she's not really having the breakdown. Her husband is. She doesn't get the funny one-liners Jennifer Coolidge does. So she's basically just there to be, like, in the middle, kind of. Like, she wants to stay in the house, but she also knows it's dangerous. She wants to stay in her marriage, but she also knows her husband is falling apart. She wants to go to the country club and put on airs, but she also knows it's not healthy and they can't afford it. So, like, she just doesn't really have much of a personality or anything to do. So it's like a waste of an amazing actress like Naomi Watts. The real scene stealers, though, are Jennifer Coolidge, who plays a literal Karen, who is a real estate agent and is just so fucking funny. Her and Naomi Watts' character, Nora, are old friends from art school, and she has the best line in the first episode where Nora is like a ceramics artist and Karen, Jennifer Coolidge's character, like, oh my God, I saw you in the New York Times and you're still doing it. Me, I was like, nah, fuck painting, marry a rich guy. And I did. Like, that's so funny. And I really want to know how much of that is the writing versus how much is Jennifer Coolidge. Because I'd be willing to bet it's like 40% writing, if that, and 60% Jennifer Coolidge, maybe even higher on the Jennifer Coolidge scale. Wonderful. And then Margot Martindale, who plays the most insane neighbor based on the real life couple who faced their lawn chairs toward the house, is accused at some point of like being in a satanic cult that eats babies, of committing suicide and then coming back to life. Fucking wild. The show is wild, but not in a way, like, I'm all over the place. How do I want to say this? It's a wild show, but it's all grounded. Like, it's wild, but it's wild in the way that, like, people who are really into true crime have wild theories. Like, it's not American Horror Story wild, where, like, you think, oh, we're seeing someone, like, American Horror Story Hotel, for example, where, like, you think that, or it's presented as like there are serial killers in this hotel, but then also it's vampires and ghosts. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not that crazy where it's like supernatural, but it's crazy in that it's like they think that their neighbors are in a satanic baby eating cult, or that like someone has hired a person to creep around their house in the middle of the night. And that there's a security installation person who like hides a camera in their bedroom and just watches it. That like people just materialize, but like there's no logical explanation. But you know that there is one because it is grounded. Like, it never goes to the supernatural place. You know that like this is just a person fucking with other people. But like when that happens, we need an explanation for it. Like, as people, we are just wired to need to know answers. Like, as curious creatures, that is what we need. We need to know how and why things are the way they are. So we know that, like, because this is a real story and it takes place in the real world at a very real address in a very real town, we know that the answer isn't like a dead girl is in, you know, Dean Brannock's bedroom at night. We know that's not the case. How did she get there, though, and who is she, is a different story. Did she get there because she was summoned by a baby-eating cult? Is she there because someone who wants the house to scare them away so they can buy it at a lower price point and flip it? Maybe. So, like, there is it the mentally ill person across the street? Is it the crazy lady who only cares about the trees and the dumbwaiter? Like, is it people who know there are tunnels under the house that used to connect it to other houses in the neighborhood? Which, again, used to be very real, especially in the Midwest. I just read this book that was set in St. Cloud, Minnesota, where entire towns had tunnels built underneath the road so they could, like, get to work when they couldn't get out of their houses. So it doesn't go to, like, those crazy lengths, but it goes to, like, a crazy length that is not as, and because it doesn't go there, it's not as entertaining, if that makes sense. Like, because it is grounded, it never gets to the level of crazy that I think I was personally anticipating and that I think would make the show worthy of it being 7 episodes. Because if it's just a stalker series and it's just about, like, pressure being put on people to the extent that they, like, start to lose their minds, I understand that that is a story that can be told that does not need to be told in 7 45 to 55 minute episodes. Like, if that's the story you're telling, it starts to lose steam. There are some genuinely creepy segments in the show. There's a lot of, like, animal death, though. Like, if you are a person who is triggered by animal murder, do not watch the show. They kill a ferret and a dog at different points. And, like, you know, there are some great shots where you just, like, you see a figure blocking the screen, but you don't know it's blocking the screen until they move, or you see it in the background. So all that is really cool. But, like, honestly, it doesn't go there. Like, it's weird to me that all this shit happens and, like, at no point do they bring in, like, an exorcist or, I don't know, like, a paranormal investigator or something. Because, like, I'm sorry, but even if, like, even in the real world, people just do that. You know, they do seances. They smudge their houses. Like, I feel like that's almost normalized, if only because, like, we want to rule it out. That makes no sense, really, but watch anything. You know, like, talk to anyone who buys a house. Even if it's like you have a priest come over and bless it. That's very normal for Christian religions or, you know, Christian denominations, that you do house blessings. It's even part of, what, the Epiphany, maybe? Something like that, where, like, priests go out and just, like, draw symbols on your house to bless it. Or they will, like, walk into different rooms and bless them. And that's an exorcism. You know, it's not the movie The Exorcist, but it's an exorcism. So I found it strange and never went to that place. So it's like, it's just there. Like, it's not a complete bore because they do have some interest. And Noma Dumezweni steals the whole thing. She is fucking phenomenal. Bobby Cannavale is fucking phenomenal. But it's just, it's weird storytelling. It's convenient storytelling. And it never really reaches, like, a height of craziness that makes it fun. And it never really hits a height of, like, that it's better made than everything else that's about stalking people. Do you know what I'm saying? I don't know if that even makes sense, but that's my whole feeling, is that, like, I don't feel like I wasted my life, but I also know that I actually did. Like, as I was watching it, it didn't feel like a waste, but after I finished, I was like, oh, I really did not need to sit through that. And slightly spoiler, but also just fair warning, I mentioned that there is no ending to the real life story. So keep that in mind when you watch the show, if you plan to watch this show. And that's what I will say about that. Like, that's another thing, again, with, like, the real world versus the fictionalized world. You fictionalize this story very heavily. Like, you basically took the idea of people move into a house and get creepy letters from someone named The Watcher. That's basically all that's from and the address. That's all that's from the real story. Why then did you not make up an ending? Why leave it open-ended? That is frustrating. Like, we get an idea of, like, what, like, you're probably, like, 80 to 90% sure who did this and what they did. But it's not definitive because it ends with that title card from the real story that, like, this was never solved. We don't actually know what happens. Like, there is still a question of, like, what was that, this person, or was it something or someone else? You never actually know. And the weird behavior continues in the neighborhood in the series. So, like, that's slightly spoilerish, but also not really if you've read the real life story, which, honestly, read the story on, I think it's from The Cut, which is part of New York Magazine. Read the story by Reeves Wiederman rather than watching this show, honestly. Okay, that's The Watcher on Netflix. All episodes are currently streaming, 7 of them to be exact. Okay, let's talk about my other spoopy little Halloween series that I have been watching and actually fucking loving, is Interview with the Vampire on AMC and AMC Plus. Okay, confession. I haven't really, I'm going to get really close and whisper and hope that this picks up. I don't really read Anne Rice. Now, I know that that's, like, a little sacrilege as a big reader, as an English teacher, and also as a gay person. Because I know, like, a lot of gay people, especially maybe, like, one or two generations older than me, so, like, in their 40s, 50s, 60s, like, kind of turn to the Lestat novels, in particular Interview with the Vampire, as, like, a source of kind of, like, queer love. Like, I don't know in the books if it was ever very explicit, because it wasn't in the movie with Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise. But, like, that also, gay fever dream of the 90s, having, you know, Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise playing coded queer lovers in, like, long hair and frilly outfits, going to the opera and, like, you know, living together in the same bedroom. Like, of course, gay people love this shit. But I've only seen the movie once, like, way back in the 90s, and I've never read the books. I've read other Anne Rice books, but never the Vampire series. I've read her Mummy series, which is terrible, do not recommend, but I've read all three of them. But I do love her son, Christopher Rice. I've read all of his books, and I love most of them, especially his early books. He's been writing some stuff that I'm not... Why? You don't care. Anyway, the point is, this particular series has been in development for quite a number of years. It was, like, at one point going to be new movies. It was going to be a TV series that was going to be on Hulu, I think at one point had it. And it's been in development hell for a very long time. At one point, it was going to be, what the hell, The Body Thief, I want to say, is the name of the book in the series that Christopher Rice wrote as a movie. And it was going to kind of be like a reboot of Interview with the Vampire, which then had The Queen of the Damned as kind of an indirect sequel, but also starred Lestat. And like that was supposed to then start a new series of films. Then Anne and Christopher were doing a series together and they were developing. And then Anne Rice unfortunately passed away in December of 2021. So I thought that meant that this was going to languish again. But instead, basically AMC bought the rights and severed in a lot of ways, not entirely because they're still credited as executive producers, but like stopped working with Anne and because she's no longer with us, and Christopher, and went with Rolin Jones as the creator and I think showrunner for the first season. He has worked on Weeds, and he was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for his play The Intelligent Design of Jenny Chow. He used to write for Boardwalk Empire and Friday Night Lights. He's been nominated for the Writers Guild of America. He award for Friday Night Lights. He was also nominated for an Emmy for writing on Friday Night Lights. So like, not that he's not like a nobody, right? But I mean, it finally got to us with him in charge. And the changes that have been made to this, I think, are absolutely wonderful. So from what I remember of the movie, it is very white, as you would expect, because they're supposed to be European. It takes place in like Italy and France. They were like coded as lovers, but never explicitly described. Lestat and Louis were kind of, they towed that line. And the whole overarching story is that Louis is telling his story to a person who's going to write a book about him. The interviewer, who Daniel was Christian Slater in the movie, is Eric Bogosian in the TV series, who I also love. He's been, I think he was on Ray Donovan, maybe I'm making that up, but he wrote and starred in Talk Radio, which is a great play. Anyway, and he's telling his story and kind of wants to get his story out there to let people know that this is real, that vampires are real. This is what happened to him. In this version on the TV series, Louis is black and he is from New Orleans. So we have the French connection, but it's not really France. And Lestat is French and does, you know, comes over in the, what, early 1910s, I want to say, I think it takes place. So it's, I believe, pre-Prohibition, but segregated South. It's very interesting, but regardless, Louis is black, Lestat is white. So there's a very much a like a metaphorical representation of the vampirism when Lestat turns Louis that feeds into like the racism of the time and really like makes that otherness pop in Louis. And then on top of that, Louis is gay or queer. They never really define it because it's a time when I don't think the language even actually existed, but he lays down with men. He is attracted only to men, and he and Lestat become lovers, but then, and it's very explicitly shown, not like that there's like penetration or anything, but like they show them together and that they are very much a couple. So great. But then it's really about the dissolution, not only of their relationship, but Louis not being able to accept the killer side of him and the vampiric side of him very much is a part of, or comes out of, his racial and sexual identity in ways that I think, because Lestat is so much older as a person and as a creature, doesn't really understand, because he's kind of lost that human side of himself and is purely in it for pleasure, basically. And they have that conversation quite often where Lestat is trying to get Louis to feed and to feed on people and to take pleasure in killing, because that is what he is designed to do. He is a killer. He is a predator. He is higher on the food chain than people are. But Louis isn't comfortable with that because he's always been the prey. So he can't be the predator because as a queer black man who was disowned by his family, who has suffered tragedy in his human life and in his vampire life, he cannot accept the killer side of himself. He doesn't want that side of himself. He wants to balance out the evil that is within him by eating animals instead of by eating people, or, you know, by not using his abilities to the extent that he can. He wants to hold on to that human side of himself because, you know, maybe because even though he is a vampire, he is now stronger than he was able to be as a queer black man when he was alive. But there's still the discrimination there where, like, he's still treated differently because even though people don't know he's a vampire, he is still a gay black man. And in particular, in New Orleans, a black man it's obviously very hard in the early 1900s to be that. And, you know, he runs a brothel and it's in a black area, even though it caters to white men and women, I guess. But, like, so as laws are coming out that are kind of discriminating against his source by his own clientele, there's like a political angle to it as well. And, like, where does the shift happen? Does Louis ever become the thing that he hates? Because he, you know, like, as a gay black man in the South, you would think he would want revenge. Those powers, they come with a price, but, like, why not use that to your advantage? But then he's also thinking about, like, he has this long life ahead of him, but then what are the things he's going to miss out on? You know, he doesn't have his family anymore. He can't stay the same age while his family, the ones that still will speak to him, age. He will never have children because he's technically dead and he's in a relationship with a man. So that's introducing us to the next episode, which is coming out this weekend, where they turn Claudia, a child, into a vampire so that they will have a child, basically. But then even then, like, what does that mean to, like, introduce a child to a world like theirs? It's a lot of questions. It introduces some really, like, sticky and fascinating questions about, like, history, because Louis is black and he lives on a plantation. What does that, in the antebellum South, what does that mean? Like, what does it mean, and how, and which parts of his identity are the ones that are really sticking out to whom? You know, like, his mother obviously is not with him being black, because she's also black, but, like, not okay so much with the gay thing, but it's not the gay thing that sends her over the edge. It's the vampire thing. But, like, is the evil that she sees in him the vampire, or is it his homosexuality? This, like, the theme of, like, inheritance, you know, like, how do people become vampires is that they are drained of their blood and it's replaced by a vampire's, you know, possessed or demonic or whatever blood, vampire blood. So, like, you inherit that literally. There's that lineage. But there's also the inheritance of racism and homophobia and misogyny and Christianity and, like, all these, like, learned practices and ideas that we pass along that just continue to destroy and destroy. And, like, that's part of the reason that Louis eventually tells his story, is to kind of break that cycle, I think. And I think, honestly, it's an improvement over the film. The acting is superb. It is Sam Reed, who I'm not all that familiar with. He plays Lestat. He is an Australian actor. What the heck was he in that was popular here? I can't find it. He was in, The Astronaut Wives Club. But other than that, he's done, like, mostly BBC type stuff. He was also in The Hatfields and McCoys with Kevin Costner, but he's, like, a relative newbie. He's Australian, but he's wonderful and very intoxicating as Lestat, and then Jacob Anderson as Louis, who was in Game of Thrones. Jesus, why? He was Grey Worm in Game of Thrones. So he probably is known to folks, but not really to me. So I'm kind of discovering all these people as they're being introduced. And then like Eric Bogosian, I mentioned, Ray Don Chong plays Louis' mother. It's a really, I don't know, I guess I was expecting it to be bad for some reason. Maybe it's because it took so long to get to the screen, because Christopher Rice, even though he's credited as an executive producer, I follow him on I think every social media platform, he's like renounced the show, and every time one of his fans asks about it, he just says, I have no comment, I'm directing everything to AMC, and he like tags them. So I don't know what the fuck happened there, but like there's some bad blood. So I guess I just anticipated it not being great based on that, and also based on how closely so many people hold this book and the 1994 movie. I guess I expected it to try to be those things, and it's really not. It's really its own thing. Like, it's made some, the changes are, like, it keeps the spirit of what I can remember anyway from the movie, and it keeps the relationships, but, like, the angles that those relationships take are very different and very contemporary, I think. And like, that's maybe the most interesting part, is to take the story that the book has been around for 50 years, the movie's been around for almost 30 years, and then to take these characters that are steeped in like older history and update them in a way that like even makes the history feel contemporary is very interesting and successful, I think. So yeah, it airs 10 o'clock p.m. on AMC on Sunday nights. Or you can watch episodes a week ahead of time on AMC Plus if you have that. And then AMC is going to be spinning this off into like a shared Anne Rice world called Immortals. And they're also going to be adapting her Mayfair Witches books into a series that will start streaming only on AMC Plus in January. I'm not happy about that because I want to watch that show, but I'm not paying for AMC Plus. So if any of you have it and want to share a code or your password, please feel free. I might just do like a trial once the whole thing's out and just watch the full season. Who knows? But I'm tired of all of these streaming services bullshit, like especially with AMC Plus, like you're just showing AMC things a week early. I have cable. I'm just going to watch it when it airs. I'm like, I'm not going to pay for a service for one show. Sorry about it. But regardless, and they've also already renewed the show for a season two. So it also makes me wonder exactly where in the book slash movie they're going to stop this season, because like as of now we're about halfway through, only 7 episodes, we're about halfway through the series and Claudia hasn't even shown up yet. So are they going to go to Europe at some point, or is that season two? I don't know. Okay, I do recommend this show in case that wasn't clear. Sundays at 10 on AMC, definitely of these two that I'm talking about this week, the better, like for sure. So let's talk about the premieres and finales this week. On Monday, we have season two of Wild Crime, which I recommended sometime last year, maybe right around this time. This is a Hulu documentary series about crimes that take place in national parks. And this is season two. It's 4 episodes. That releases on Monday. And then it's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. New episodes come out next week, and that's the end. And then VH1 is rebooting The Surreal Life. The show from, I want to say, the early 2000s, of where like a bunch of like C and D list celebrities move into a house together. And I don't remember who is on this season, but if you watch this show back in the day, you know what a fucking shit show it was. And they're bringing it back. They're bringing it back. So it's going to be, okay, here's the cast. Ready? Dennis Rodman, Frankie Muniz, Stormy Daniels, Manny MUA, Kim Coles, Tamar Braxton, August Alsina, and CJ Perry. Now, I don't know who half those people are, but I do know that Dennis Rodman is crazy, so it's probably going to be a shit show. That's coming to VH1 on Monday. On Tuesday, the new season of the Boulay Brothers' Dragula premieres on Shudder with 2 episodes. The theme this season is Titans, which is their version of All Stars. I'm very excited for that. And then Guillermo del Toro has a Netflix series that releases its first batch of episodes on Tuesday and then continues throughout the week called Cabinet of Curiosities. on Thursday, Siesta Key comes back to MTV, and then again with the crazy longtime reboots, season 19 of MTV Cribs. Like, what fucking year is it? What year is it? The Surreal Life and MTV Cribs all coming back in the same week? What's happening? We have Interview with the Vampire on TV. We have The Surreal Life, MTV Cribs. What's going on? What, the Star Trek series are back on Paramount Plus. Inside Amy Schumer is back on Paramount Plus. What are we doing? What is happening? On Friday, Netflix releases the sixth season of Big Mouth. And on Sunday, it is the long-awaited return of The White Lotus. The second season is taking place in Sicily. For finales, it is the... We're getting the last episodes of The Patient, Reboot, The D'Amelio Show, and Tell Me Lies, all on Hulu. Real Housewives of Beverly Hills finally wraps up its season on Wednesday. Star Trek Lower Decks and Star Trek Prodigy are done on Thursday. Vampire Academy on Peacock is done on Thursday. And then on Sunday, Stars has the finale of Serpent Queen, Halloween Wars on Food Network, and the second season of Stanley Tucci Searching for Italy, which is newly an Emmy-winning show on CNN. Okay, so again, keeping up with the spoopy theme of the episode, I am recommending another queer horror movie that is currently streaming. So The Watcher wasn't like strictly queer, but you know, it's Ryan Murphy. And Interview with the Vampire is very, very queer. Not explicitly. They slash them is explicitly queer. That is my recommendation for the week. They slash them, and that is the proper pronunciation because it's a pun. It's a horror movie. They slash them. Get it? Is streaming on Peacock. This came out in August, and it's been pretty universally panned by critics and a lot of audiences, but I personally really liked it and had a great time with it. And it is about a group of teenagers who go to a conversion camp, which, if you were unaware, is real, where you go to camp and they basically try to make you straight. And these teenagers are there for different reasons. Some actually want to change. Some are there because their parents are forcing them. Most are there because their parents are forcing them. Some are there because they're like, they made a deal where if they went and it worked, they would change. But if it didn't, then their parents would stop hounding them, whatever. But it is a very explicitly queer cast of people who go to this camp, Whistler Camp, and it's run by Kevin Bacon. Kevin Bacon, who I will always love, plays this like really charismatic, kind of like hippy dippy down to earth. I'm not like other moms. I'm a cool mom of like conversion camp people named Owen, where like he's trying to be respectful of their pronouns while also, you know, trying to turn them into people that they're not. So he separates them into like boys' cabin, girls' cabin, and then we're left with Jordan, who is non-binary and, you know, it's like, I don't feel comfortable in either place. And then that's when we hear Owen kind of like say he's going to work with them. That starts to like erode, and we start to see like slowly the darker side of the camp when we realize like they're people who are on hormones are having their hormones kept from them, which can be very damaging medically for people. If you didn't know, like if you're on a hormone replacement schedule and you just stop, it can like your body can go haywire. So like just from a health standpoint, that's not great. But regardless, then they like make them do these activities to, you know, like butch up the femme ones where like they're learning how to use guns and archery and all that kind of shit. And it's just, if you've never kind of, if you're unfamiliar with the conversion camp phenomena and are not sure why they are now illegal in many states and in Canada, this will probably open your eyes as to why. Then like the movie goes on and we kind of start to find out that the whole thing is darker than we even thought. Meanwhile, there's a murderer killing people around the camp. And we're unsure, is it someone who works at the camp? Is it someone who's attending the camp? Is it someone related to the camp at all? And it moves from like a drama to a psychological thriller. There's an aversion therapy scene, which you may be familiar with from season 2 of American Horror Story, where basically like it's part of the conversion process that is definitely, I feel like this is illegal everywhere now. I don't want to, maybe I'm wrong on that, but basically they would hook you up to electrodes. And let's say you are a gay man and they want to make you into a straight man. They would hook you up to electrodes and show you pictures of like women in bikinis or naked women. And that was like the baseline. Then they would show you pictures of naked or half naked men. And then they would zap you with the electrodes. basically over and over and over, and then they would not zap you when it was the female and zap you when it was the male, basically to like have a bodily response that the way you respond to naked men is going to, you're going to associate that with pain so that you won't get boners, basically. There's a scene of that. Avert your eyes if you need to, but know that that's there. And then from there, it gets even darker and turns into a slasher movie, which, again, I love those too. And like I said, this got panned when it came out. And part of it is that it like does not really know what it wants to be. Like, is it a drama? Is it a thriller? Is it a horror film? It's kind of all of them. But why I really appreciate it, one, Kevin Bacon is very good. Two, Theo Germain, who plays Jordan, is also very good. It has a queer cast, play queer people playing queer roles. We need more of that. And it is very explicitly for and by queer people. It is directed by John Logan, who has been nominated for a bunch of Academy Awards. He wrote Hugo and what else he write? Gladiator, I think, and something else. And he also wrote Sweeney Todd, the movie. He's written like some James Bond movies. And he is openly gay. So he got to finally tell it, like, he spent all these years writing like these blockbusters and stuff. And, you know, now he gets to finally tell a queer story, and he also directed it. So like, even though it's not perfect and, you know, like it's not, I don't know, maybe it would have been even better with a better director, I thought the story it told was important. And I thought it was a lot of fun. Like, it's finally a story where the queer people are not just the targets, or if they are the targets, they reclaim their power. And to see a bunch of queer actors playing queer characters, like fighting back against these oppressive forces, was great. And seeing like the hate being targeted by this slasher in this is also great. I loved all of that. I want more of that. I want more uprisings of angry queer people. That's what I want going into 2023. So They Slash Them is streaming now on Peacock, and I think you can rent it other places as well. But again, I really enjoyed it, and it's gay as fuck, and it's Halloween. So like, we've all seen, you know, I said this last week, but like, we've all seen the usual Halloween fare. Like, you probably have seen, if you have Peacock, you also probably have seen the new Halloween movie, which is not good. They Slash Them, I thought, was better than the new Halloween movie. Maybe not a popular opinion, but, you know, like, instead of watching Scream again or Hocus Pocus again or the entire Nightmare on Elm Street or, you know, whatever marathons on AMC during the day, watch something that is independent, that is strictly queer or, like, or black. Like, the new Candyman is very black. From a very black perspective, watch a Nope by Jordan Peele. I think is going to be streaming on Peacock soon, and I'm pretty sure it's available to rent and home. Like, watch something like that instead of the usual shit, because like the swing for the fences stuff, even when you miss, is much more interesting to me. You know, like American Horror Story this season, I'm really enjoying so far. I might talk about it later on, but like, it swings for the fences and doesn't work for everyone, but it works for me. And again, even when it doesn't work, I find it laudable. I like when things do that. They Slash Them swings for the fences, doesn't hit it out of the park, but, you know, maybe gets like a really close double. If you watch baseball, that makes sense to you. So yeah, that's streaming now on Peacock. The Watcher is on Netflix, and Interview with the Vampire airs Sunday nights at 10 on AMC, or you can find on AMC Plus. Okay, so next week, my recommendations, again, are going back to Countdown to Christmas, because that is happening, so tune in for that, and for more news, recommendations, analyses, have a good week, everyone!